Welcome back to the Mining Pod. On today's show, we are joined by Nazar Khan of TerraWulf and Michael Gao of Fabric to discuss ZK ASIC hardware. It's the bleeding edge of hardware for crypto, and we go through why a Bitcoin miner would be interested in working with a ZK hardware team, go through what ZK hardware is in the first place, how it's developed, what are the markets for ZK hardware, and how a Bitcoin miner could experiment with putting ZK hardware into its mining fleet. Thank you to both Fabric and TerraWulf for making this show possible. At the end of the show, you'll notice that we are missing some videos. If you're watching this on CoinDesk TV or on the Blockspace YouTube channel, we apologize for that. We just had one camera die right at the end there. We missed out on it. So it happens, but we got great audio. So if you're tuning in, just listening, we got that for you. It's recorded in the studio at ETH Denver. Thanks for listening. Also check out Forman Mining. You'll hear more from Forman Mining a little bit later in this episode. Thank you to them for sponsoring. Okay, on to the show.
Want to mine Bitcoin? Gator Mining offers premium hosting with as low as one unit per client. 95% uptime guaranteed, no curtailment, 24/7 monitoring and maintenance, in-house certified repair center. Clean and renewable energy, all at competitive market rates. Work with an individualized team to get hash rate flowing your way today. Gator Mining, pioneering trustworthy crypto hosting for optimal mining success. Contact Gator Mining today at gatormining.ca.
Bitcoin miners, be prepared. Hash rate is moving upstream towards power plants and low-value energy. Don't get cut off. Modernize and mobilize your Bitcoin mining fleet today with Upstream Data's high-performance load centers. Plug in Upstream Data's hash hut and monetize surplus wind power reliably in the blistering heat of West Texas. Plumb in hash generators and safely convert natural gas into cash in the frigid winters of northern Canada. Upstream offers high-quality load centers that will help you mine Bitcoin safely and reliably in every application and climate. Mobilize today and start mining Upstream at upstreamdata.com.
Are you a retail or institutional investor interested in Bitcoin mining companies? The Miner Mag brings you free data and analysis from all major NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin mining operations to know who stands out. Check out visualized metrics and data-dependent stories at theminermag.com. Welcome to the Mining Pod, guys. Excited for this conversation today. It's been a long time coming.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Super excited to be here. And
thanks for having me back.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so we'll start with bios. I think people who listen to like the normal Mining Pod feed probably know who you guys are. Maybe not Michael quite yet because you haven't been on the show. But the CoinDesk feed, which we're on now, you get lots of people who are just interested in mining for the first time since price is pumping. So I'll hand over to you guys. Michael, I'll give it to you first for a bio.
My background's kind of weird. I was a winner of the USA Math Olympiad, finalist in the Computing Olympiad when I was a kid. You know, zero social skills, total math nerd. And when I was 15, you know, I was looking to start a business online. And this is back in 2011. And tried to start a PayPal, got banned from PayPal because I was underage. Tried to start a bank account. My parents wouldn't drive me to the bank. And so finally, I was like, okay, there's got to be an alternative, right? And so I found Bitcoin. 2011, it was $11.19. And I remember like seeing, you know, mountgox.com at the time, and it was this like very historic feeling because I felt like, oh my God, this thing is going to be a thing. Like somehow I just had that intuition. So I started doing various things. You know, at first I put up a website, made 500 coins. Took those coins, invested in GPU mines all across the US, made 3,000 coins. And I took those coins and I kind of made a degen bet into the very first Bitcoin ASIC. It was this company out of Shenzhen in China, started by this guy called Fried Cat, pseudonymous founder on Bitcoin Talk. This was August 2012. And these guys were offering shares, quote unquote, over Bitcoin Talk. And they were like taping out this ASIC. It was going to come out. It was going to be way better than the GPU, way better than FPGA. And I was like, wow, you know, if this works, it's going to be so big. I might as well put my money in this thing. And oh my God, over the next year, Bitcoin went from like $10 to $100. You know, my Bitcoins grew to like 12,000 Bitcoins. And suddenly I was like, oh my God, you know, I made a real business online from doing this mining stuff. And so then I invested all my, you know, I put $1 million worth of my net worth into this company called Hashfast. Hashfast was doing a 28 nanometer Bitcoin mining chip. And I bought a bunch of their miners. So This is my first foray into actually mining myself. And unfortunately, the chip worked, but the board didn't. So I wound up, you know, getting a call from someone at Hashfest, and they were like, yeah, sorry, this company's going bankrupt. You're getting nothing.
Well, really unfamiliar story and for Bitcoin mining.
I was 17. I was like way in over my head. And I was like, can you just give me the raw chips? And they're like, yeah, if you want them. So I signed a settlement with them in which they gave me the raw silicon. And I had to figure out, okay, how do I put this on a board? So I actually skipped school, you know, flew out to San Francisco and started hustling, you know, went going to contract manufacturers, getting my mom to sign contracts, faxing contracts back and forth. And it was kind of crazy, but we managed to get 1,000 systems working and tested. Mm-hmm. And then Bitcoin fell from $1,200 to $300. And I got wiped out. So went to MIT, dropped out, started a software company, you know, sold it to Google for a small acquihire kind of exit. And found out that I wasn't cut out for SaaS. I was not supposed to do SaaS. And so I caught the hardware bug again. And I was like, I'm going to go back into hardware. And right around this time, you know, one of my friends approached me and he was super depressed. And he had this resume. And he was like, Michael, can you like find something for me to do? Like find me a life purpose. And this is August 2017. And I look at his resume. And on his resume, there is photonics. And I'm like, okay, so this looks potentially useful. You know, photonics, computing with light instead of electricity. Like, you could probably do a lot with that. And the first thing that I tried to, like, figure out was, like, can you use this for Bitcoin? No. So then I was like, okay, what else can you use it for? And it turned out that it could be used for low-power, super-efficient, super-cost-effective artificial intelligence. And so, you know, I talked to the grad student that he had worked with for that research project, and we founded a company called Luminous Computing. And Luminous was building these next generation high performance supercomputers for AI based on photonics, and which is really cool. I mean, like, this is, you know, orders of magnitude improvements over what conventional electronics can do. And so this was like the first company where I really had to dive into hardware. Mm-hmm. As a hardware designer, right? Like, so although I was a co-founder and I was chief strategy officer, I also eventually had to take on more and more knowledge about photonics. And eventually I started inventing stuff. So I invented some stuff around photonics, computer architecture, how to use photonics to do computing. And what I came to realize was that, you know, if you sit at the intersection of all these different disciplines, right, and you can see the blind spots that each discipline brings to it, you can create really awesome stuff. So eventually we raised $130 million. Bill Gates was an investor. We hired a rock star team, of which one of the people was one of the founders of the field of silicon photonics. And it was on a really great trajectory until, you know, there is this fork in the road, right? We could either go for large language models or we could go for ads. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, at this time, you know, it was 2021, large language models really didn't have a market. Yeah. And ads, on the other hand, always have a market. And so everyone wanted to go for the ads. I said, I'm not going to sign up for that. And so I went back into crypto, you know, mm-hmm. kind of looking to kind of decentralize the internet. And so I did Bitcoin mining for a while, teamed up with an awesome chip designer that I'd known for quite a while. And we founded Katina Computing Technologies, which was a custom Bitcoin ASIC miner that you guys have been talking about.
Yeah.
Tried to do Bitcoin mining for a while until we signed this amazing $150 million purchase order with CoinMint. And we were super excited to work with them. I'd heard about CoinMint for really years. Yeah. And then, you know, was super glad to finally have them as a customer. And unfortunately, they defaulted and didn't pay on time. And this was the height of the supply chain crisis. It was 2021. Nobody could get wafers. You know, nobody could get any parts. You know, even the package that the chips went on, those were in shortage. You know, even the capacity to make the boards, that was in shortage. Everything was in shortage.
Yeah.
And so their default caused us to essentially miss out on that window of opportunity when China banned Bitcoin mining, where difficulty was low, prices were decent. Like, it was like a really good time in Bitcoin mining that unfortunately we missed out on. So 2022, you know, they ended up taking us to arbitration, trying to get out of this contract in which there were liquidated damages, right? In which, hey, you know, if you default on this, it caused Katina a lot of damages, you're on the hook, right? And so I'm happy to talk more about that case, but basically last 2 weeks, I think we won $14 million in a final judgment in that arbitration. We're really happy that this was the outcome. And that was 14 on top of the money that they had paid us, which some of that even had to go into the supply chain to procure the parts that we ended up not manufacturing because we didn't get the whole payment. And so, you know, super, super proud of our legal team and, you know, our team and weathering through that. And basically in late, you know, 2022, I was like, okay, it looks like I missed the boat on Bitcoin mining thanks to this, unfortunately. And so I was casting around with, you know, Sagar, my co-founder at Katina, Tina, you know, an early employee at Katina, and we're looking around for new applications, right? And one of the things that we saw was that zero-knowledge proofs were really taking off. And we were even starting to see, like, a few people ask us, hey, are you making a ZK ASIC? Are you making this thing? And, you know, it was like, oh my God, that's a new thought. So I started looking on Google Scholar and reading the papers. I love to delve deep into the papers and see where the field is going. And I started seeing that zero-knowledge proofs were just this one thing among a host of cryptography algorithms that were coming out. You know, there was fully homomorphic encryption, which was starting to come out. You know, cryptography started looking a lot like AI in 2012. It started looking like a really interesting field to be in. And the compute, you know, demand was going exponential. And it seemed bottlenecked by the same things that artificial intelligence had been bottlenecked by in the 2010s. And so I started germinating on this idea of, like, maybe I should make a chip for this.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we brought on Dave, our co-founder and CTO at Fabric. We put together a company in January last year. And, you know, we grew that company in 1 year from zero to 40 people. You know, we have $60 million in purchase orders. We have, you know, pre-orders with deposits down, basically. And we are closing around right now, but, you know, quite a bit of equity funding as well. And so incredibly proud of the work that we've done there. But, you know, it's gone really fast. And the field is just on the cusp of becoming a really, really big deal, not just financially, but also in terms of the societal impact. And so that's one thing I'm excited to talk about more.
Yeah, you're going to be in the hot seat because we got lots of questions here, which is why you're on the podcast.
No, I'll throw it to you for same thing, bio. Keep it long, keep it short, your choice. But
it's tough to follow up, yeah. Michael's story. I've been in the power business for 20 plus years. Kind of came out of college, did investing, and then, you know, ended up investing in a power asset. So got into power, you know, co-founded Terra Wolf with Paul Prager, who's our CEO. So for 20 plus years, we were running around, you know, not just the United States, but around the world, developing power generation facilities. And these were both thermal and renewable. And so when you're developing a power plant, it's both understanding kind of power flows, you know, where to put power onto the grid, where it's needed, and where you can kind of get the best price for that power. And then there's a whole capital and financing structure associated with it as well. So large CapEx, big projects. 2018, 2019 or so, you know, I like to say the business of selling wholesale electricity has fundamentally changed in the United States. There's a significant transition happening in the supply side, and that's manifesting itself in what I call kind of a, you know, the loss of true markets. And so, you know, we were sitting around saying, hey, we can kind of keep doing what we've been doing, but it's like banging your head against the wall. You know, it's not, we're not able to produce a kilowatt hour of electricity for X and sell it for X plus something. And so I said, hey, if I can have a load and I can then manage around that load, I can probably make some money because then I can arbitrage it against the grid, but I also have a place to sink the power. First started looking at data centers, you know, and quickly tumbled into Bitcoin. So this is kind of 2018, studied Bitcoin. And once I understood it, I said, hey, this is amazing. So started buying Bitcoin. And everyone kept telling me that the largest, single largest input to mining Bitcoin is power. So I started talking to all the folks who at the time were large scale Bitcoin miners. And I quickly came to the conclusion that most folks didn't really know what they're talking about when it came to energy and power and infrastructure. And so decided to say, hey, you know, I'm no genius, but I've been doing this for 20 years and these folks haven't been. And so we should be able to do this in a better way. So that's kind of how our journey in Bitcoin mining started. And, you know, we did an initial project for Marathon back in 2020, and then, you know, started TerraWolf in 2021. And so, you know, we've built TerraWolf up. We're, you know, going to hit 8 exahash here shortly. We'll get to 10 by mid-year. And we've got another 300 or so megawatts beyond that to continue to develop. And so fundamentally, you know, our perspective is really around infrastructure and this intersection of energy and data and compute and how that can kind of feed it in. And so we've had this view that to facilitate what we, you know, what we see as kind of an exponential demand for this, whether it's for Bitcoin mining or other applications, fundamental to that is energy infrastructure. And we have a view on how that should be done. And so, again, that's been my background for 20 plus years and really identifying, developing, financing and operating, you know, these types of facilities. And so that's, you know, 2021 to 2023, you know, we've, you know, even since 2018, right, we've lived through what, 3 cycles in Bitcoin. And so we're upon another one here.
Always.
Yeah, we're recording on almost all-time high day. Yeah, 60K day.
60K day, yeah.
That's amazing.
Okay, elevator pitch time for ZK hardware. You don't have to convince me. You have to convince the audience. Why do we need ZK hardware? Like, where's the product market fit for something like this? And I know there's lots of L2s we can talk about. There's lots of different ways that ZKs are going to become important. Mm-hmm. But as a hardware manufacturer, like, why did you get into this game with ZKs?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks for asking this. And, you know, I think I can answer on several levels, right? Like, there is, like, why is it financially or economically a good decision to be in the field of ZK? But really, for me personally, the reason that I and, you know, really my co-founders and awesome team are in this field is because of the mission. And, you know, that's what really appeals to me about this whole next-gen cryptography thing, not just ZKs, but, like, we're at a point in society where trust has eroded in every major institution. And Bitcoin showed how much trust had eroded in the financial system. You know, we're seeing the same thing for elections. We're seeing the same thing for regulations in general. We're seeing the same thing for every institution that we have historically trusted. And what I'm really excited about is that zero-knowledge proofs, fully homomorphic encryption, and all these technologies are going to play really, really crucial roles in building that back up. You know, my Telegram is actually World Beyond Trust, and there's a reason for that. Our motto is World Beyond Trust because that's the world we want to build. Is zero-knowledge proofs, fundamentally what they let you do is they let you prove something without revealing the sensitive information. And if you just think about, like, the implications of this, it goes way beyond, hey, we can scale some blockchains, which is already super exciting, mm-hmm. right? It goes to, hey, we could do zero-knowledge proofs of KYC. You can be regulatory compliant while protecting people's privacy, right? You could have zero-knowledge proofs of credit scores. You can, you know, not show your social security. You can have credit scores checked on-chain. Right. You can have smart contracts that rely on credit scores. You can have under collateralized lending. Right. You can scale smart contracts, not just in terms of transactions per second. You can scale them in functionality. Mm. You can have a whole portfolio margin engine in a smart contract. Right. So there are just amazing things that are coming out that are going to be able to migrate, you know, much more of the financial system into smart contracts. And also, you know, I think it's very topical. Today, I saw that SBF is asking for a 6-year sentence. You know, people like SBF couldn't do what they did mm-hmm. if ZKs existed and were in widespread use. If ZKs were ubiquitous, an exchange would never be able to be insolvent. I mean, how compelling is that? Bernie Madoff could not happen. He could, you know, not disclose his trading strategy, and he'd still be able to prove mm-hmm. that he was making a certain amount of trading returns. And the very fact that he could do that would mean that he couldn't get away with it.
Let's go into that a little more, like, in that specific example here with an exchange. So how would we use, like, a ZK to prove, like, the solvency of an exchange?
Yeah, that's a great question. So basically, you know, you would be able to prove that someone's account is included in some sort of total. And you'd be able to prove that that total is, you know, they call it ZK proof of reserves. You would be able to prove that the exchange's assets are greater than the liabilities and that this person's assets and liabilities are included in that total, mm-hmm. right? So basically, you can prove that the exchange is solvent, right? And you can even have price oracles that are ZK price oracles that actually prove that, hey, if I take every single cryptocurrency that the exchange holds and you convert it all, you know, like it has this kind of leverage ratio on this thing or that thing, like you can do all sorts of summary statistics also with ZK.
Yeah.
And so in terms of building an application here, mm-hmm. hardware, why do we need hardware?
That's why I'm here, right?
Yeah.
Basically, I saw the same thing with ZK that you really see with any field of computing, right? So in the 1980s, computers were really hard to use, right? And today, computers are super easy to use. Everyone carries not just laptops, but, you know, we all have these amazing phones that have basically what would have been a supercomputer in 1980, mm-hmm. right? And so the role of the compute provider, you know, and the semiconductor industry is to democratize access to new computing technologies. That is the goal of any chip company, fundamentally, is to stamp out the same chip billions of times and give it to everybody. And then having that orders of magnitude improvement in compute unlocks new use cases. So what I really see for ZK is today, in order to make a ZK application, you have to be a cryptographer. You have to be an expert in cryptography. What these chips are going to allow you to do is scale up ZK to the point where you can run arbitrary programs mm-hmm. in ZK, right? Like our partners at NIL and Resira, they're doing this. You know, they're actually building, you know, ZK circuit compilers that can take an arbitrary existing piece of code. It could be, you know, your credit score risk model, right? Like, and they can make a ZK of it with no change. And I just think that's amazing because that's going to unlock access to this mm-hmm. and, you know, really let people do that. And all of this requires massive amounts of compute. And then going even beyond that, when you talk about ZK AI and all these LLMs that people are doing, you know, imagine being able to make a zero knowledge proof. And this is thanks to our valued partners at Modulus who are doing this stuff. You know, Daniel from there was proposing that you would be able to make a proof of an English statement about your email, right? I could prove via ZK I didn't violate this NDA without showing my emails, right? Like, just imagine the awesome power of that if you could have a ZK LLM, right? So there are just new ways to trust people mm-hmm. that are just fundamentally different and change some of these trade-offs that human society has faced for millennia, basically.
Okay, so the pitch is there from a mining standpoint that we have to figure out right. how that fits together. So, Nas, I'll throw it over to you to talk about, like, the TerraWolf side. What makes you guys interested in working with something that's, like, so bleeding edge here?
So it really comes down to how do you support the compute? So if Michael's vision happens where ZKs are proving out financial transactions, contracts, LLM, AI information, that's going to require a massive amount of compute. And so fundamentally, we've seen it in the Bitcoin space, in the compute space as well. The only way that's going to happen is if it's happening at a low cost and it's happening reliably. And is happening, you know, in a way that can kind of support all these transactions. And so fundamentally, the infrastructure has to work with the hardware that exists. And so where we see value is that when we come in with a very different perspective. And so most of the folks in the ZK world are going to be more developers, are writing code. They have these, you know, these ideas around how this should work. And fundamentally, I come in and say, okay, great. If you're right, and this yeah. is not going to work once, it's going to work a million times. How is it going to work? What is it going to cost? How are you going to build it? Where is it going to operate? And how do you run it in a way that it can deliver that low cost so it can be used a million times over, you know, every minute of every day? And so that's really where we think we have value. And if you just think about, you know, some of the applications, you know, whether it's kind of, you know, we're seeing it in the AI space already, right? The amount of compute required to support the AI is, you know, growing exponentially. And likewise, in the ZK space, we see this unique opportunity where, given where ZKs are today and where they, you know, could be and should be, you know, 3, 4, 5 years out, there's going to be a significant amount of infrastructure that's required to support it. And that's where we think, you know, getting in and helping shape that is an important part of the evolution.
So on your guys' website, you have the VPU, right? And you show yeah. like the progression, CPU, GPU, FPGA, and all that. And then you kind of go through it. And you have the ZPU. And essentially, you're selling these orders out in the future to different miners. Mm-hmm. Can you disclose anything with the relationship with TerraWulf, and then also maybe like some of your larger numbers you guys are looking at, if you can't disclose that?
Naz, am I allowed to talk about this?
Sure.
Yeah. So we've been proud to have Naz and TerraWulf as partners for a long time. You know, they're an investor in Catena. They're an investor in Fabric. We're really proud to, you know, be partnering with them really closely in this like kind of infancy stage of this new wave of technology. And we're basically collaborating to put, you know, our boxes into racks, put our you know, racks into a data center, turn it on and, you know, see what happens and really iterate on that concept and hopefully, you know, be able to showcase here's what a ZK data center looks like and here's what it's powering in the real world. So, you know, we're really excited to be engaging in that.
Yeah. And, you know, at TerraWulf, you know, we've got Wulf Labs, which is where we kind of incubate and develop all these technologies. And so whether it's running A100, H100s for different AI customers or working with Fabric, you know, again, we view our ability to kind of really break down how things operate, how things run and how much they should cost to help influence where things are going. And so that's where, you know, we've been working with Michael and his team and really giving, again, our perspective on, hey, it's wonderful that you got this miner, but now let's talk about how does it work? How does it make money? And can it actually support, right? Because the other thing is when you think about kind of the economics and the proving rewards that a lot of these protocols are talking about, you know, again, translating it back and saying, okay, if you are right, and if this is going to happen at scale, does it all hold together?
Yeah.
Can I buy a VPU? Can I plug it in? Can I spend the cost of power that I have? We think we have some of the lowest cost of power. And can I make money doing that? And if I can, that's interesting. If I can't, then you kind of got to go back, you know, and kind of iterate and say, okay, well, what do we have to do to kind of make this work? Is the hardware the problem? Is the kind of the protocol the problem? Is the design the problem? And so that's where it's kind of, you know, three or four kind of sided puzzle that we're solving to kind of get these protocols to work. And so again, that's all happening within Wulf Labs. And so, you know, there's a number of great things happening, including the work we're doing with Fabric.
So you have to be the practical one is what I'm hearing. You have to look at the numbers, the economics.
Well, yeah, again, well, I was going to come down to it. If it's going to scale, it's got to make money.
Yeah.
It's, you know,
great, and you know, it'll happen at some level, but to really make it, as you know, kind of Michael said, ubiquitous, it's got to be cheap, right? And so that's where we really focus on driving things.
Hey listeners, let's talk about revolutionizing your mining operation with Foreman. This isn't your average management tool. It's an all-in-one solution for reducing costs and significantly boosting your revenue. Foreman brings a cutting-edge dashboard to your fingertips, empowering you with automated energy strategies. This means not only curtailing around real-time prices, but also strategically enhancing your profit margins through demand response. It's about leveraging energy efficiency to its fullest potential. With Foreman, you get a system that scales with your business. Inventory management for assets, infrastructure integration, and business intelligence. Foreman elevates the cash flow and production of your entire operation. To see how Foreman can redefine your mining operation standards, visit foreman.mn. With Foreman, you're not just managing a mining operation, you're setting a new standard in the industry.
I think we should probably just understand more like where you guys are at in the process of building this. So you have to go from designing the chip to a tape out process and all that. And you guys, my understanding is you guys are designers. You guys don't.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
So where are you guys at in the process? And maybe give a little education for listeners on like how this whole thing works. Because most people don't have a background in chip design, let alone chip manufacturing.
Yeah. So chip designs are extraordinarily intricate activities that involve, you know, dozens of people over an extended period of time, right? And so for Bitcoin ASICs, because they're relatively simple, because they do only one thing, usually that period would be, you know, 9 months at the very least, maybe a year. For more complex chips, usually that timeline for getting from concept all the way through to, you know, actually shipping these things in volume usually takes roughly 2.5 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And we're really proud that I think we're going to beat that by quite a bit because we've got an awesome team and because they've been working day and night, weekends over the past year to make that happen. But basically, that chip tape-out process, we are in the final innings now. We're about to send that chip off to the fab. We're a fabless chip company. So we complete that whole chip design. We do extensive simulations to verify it works. We put that chip design on things like FPGAs, you know, fully emulate the entire chip and, you know, try to see if there's bugs in any of that functionality. And once we're happy with that, we send off the design to a fab, you know, like the ones in Taiwan or, you know, places like that. And basically they'll take that design, they'll manufacture it, and they'll let us, you know, turnkey produce that at giant volume.
Okay. And you went through the same process with Katina, right?
Well, unfortunately, we didn't, because we went through that whole chip design process. Yeah. We actually, you know, had a, you know, tape outable, you know, piece of what they call GDS. It's an image of a chip. And we had all the SIMs and all the evidence. And unfortunately, because the wafer supply crisis was at its peak, and because we didn't receive that money, we had to go back to the fab and basically say, yeah, we don't have the same amount that we told you, you know.
Yeah.
And so that was a pretty messy kind of thing.
Well, it's instructive for listeners now on how this whole process works, right? Because you guys are designing in-house and then simulating it. But most people who are making chips as startups, you guys don't have the capital to go and like push this to like one of the huge foundries. Like,
right.
No one does, right?
Right.
So like, even, you know, Apple and these big companies are going to like TSMC or going to Samsung, and they're like doing a contract with them.
Exactly. Yeah. That's
so
right.
So you guys are in that process now where you're like getting close to tape out or getting close to, or like where are you at in that process?
Yeah, we're getting close. We have an account with the fab. Mm-hmm. You know, we have that access, and the supply constraints are significantly better these days.
Yeah.
So we're in a good position. We can print it out as long as, you know, we tape out. We should be able to mass produce basically this year. You know, we're going to be shipping a lot of these thousands of boxes.
Okay. And in terms of like testing these things out, when you give them to like Wolf Labs or someone else, do you guys typically just put them on FPGA and then ship it out? Or do you guys actually get to make some pre-orders? Is that even a thing in chip world where you get to like make pre-orders, something like that?
Yeah, pre-orders are a thing. And basically with Wolf Labs, what we're looking to do is do an iterative process, not just about the chip, right? Like ultimately, it's about the whole system. As I learned when I was little, you know, you have to have that whole system around it. You have to have the thermals done, the mechanical design done. The rack has to make sense, and it has to be designed in a way that, you know, TerraWolf can deploy at scale. So, you know, we're working with them closely in all these things, trying to make it something that really is usable in the real world.
Speaking of which, the TAM makes sense for what you guys are attacking if we believe that zero and ultraproofs can accomplish all these things.
Sure.
Which is to say, you know, finance specifically for now, like proving like exchange solvency all the way to like personal credit score or whatever it is. That makes sense. For Bitcoin miner, however, you guys are benchmarking everything against Bitcoin. How did you guys come to view this as something that's interesting to you? I mean, it seems to be like a labs proposal still, so pretty early.
It's early. So TerraWolf today, right, we're running about 210 megawatts of infrastructure mining Bitcoin. You know, we announced a couple months ago that we'd taken 2 megawatts to build out an AI lab, right? So we're working with different AI customers on running, you know, equipment for them, working Fabric. So, but as, you know, fundamentally, when I think about TerraWolf, right, we're a infrastructure provider, right? We provide the infrastructure. We procure the kilowatt hour of electricity, and we're a converter, right? And so in Bitcoin mining, we basically run it through an ASIC, and we're generating hash, and that has real-world value. And as we look out, you know, today we're at 210 megawatts, and just in the assets that we have, we've got over 350 megawatts yet to develop. And so, you know, we're coming out building 4. We'll come online here in June, which will kind of get us up to 245 or so. We'll get up to 300 megawatts by year end. And so, and that's all Bitcoin mining, but we still have, you know, 250 megawatts, you know, left to develop. So for us, and that's just at the sites that we have, that's not looking then into 25, 26, 27 and beyond. And so fundamentally, I think that understanding how these various forms of computer coming in, how they work together, and how they can kind of be symbiotic. And the reason I say that is from an energy demand perspective, you know, there's a lot of talk about Bitcoin miners being on one of the most responsive loads. Right. And I talked earlier about the fact that the supply side in energy is changing, right? We're losing all of the dispatchable supply side resources. They're all being replaced by non-dispatchable supply side resources. And so what that's doing is pushing kind of the responsiveness that's required in the grid to the load side. And so obviously Bitcoin miners provide one form of that. And, you know, I'd argue they're probably the most economically responsive load that exists. So that's why you see that being used a lot. But different forms of data are going to have different forms of responsiveness as well. And so as we think about, you know, just the evolution going out 3, 4, 5 years, even within kind of the data complex, being able to pair something with Bitcoin mining that is extremely responsive, we think can have value. Because again, different forms of compute may not want to be as responsive because as Bitcoin mining is. And so that's the other thing is as we think about creating portfolios of energy demand, understanding how different forms of compute work, understanding kind of the characteristics they have and the level of responsiveness they have associated with it. And I think is important in building out that portfolio that's going to be able to deliver the lowest cost of power, right? Because again, we talked earlier about, you know, how does this all work? You know, what's kind of the real world application? So fundamentally, it's always about how do you make sure that you can kind of do what you're doing at the lowest possible cost? And so as we think about these things, right, again, Bitcoin mining is amazing. We're massive believers in it. We're going to continue to do it. We're going to continue to scale up aggressively. In addition to that, you know, we do think that at these sites, there is room for other forms of compute to kind of come along, which can be, again, symbiotic to those loads. And so that's why, again, as we're looking at Wolf Labs, it's both, hey, you know, there's a lot of talk on these various things. How does it work?
Yeah.
What are the economics? What is the business case for it? Can we predictably, you know, can we work through it in a way that we can explain it to ourselves and therefore explain it back to our investors and shareholders? And then also just thinking again about the evolution, right? Because there's evolution and change happening in all sorts of, you know, areas. But the power grid is going through that same kind of evolution as well. And so as we think about our business, again, being able to maintain that lowest cost of power is going to make sure we have to ensure that the loads that we're bringing to it can kind of be the most responsive and be the biggest assets back to the grid. And so that's, again, the perspective that we're coming at it is hey, these are forms of compute that are growing, that could be very scalable, that could be massive. And how do they work together with what we're already doing?
What makes you decide to put more resources into one of those things you guys are developing in Wolf Labs or something that you guys have as a revenue line at TerraWolf?
I think it's a couple of different things, right? I mean, we've been spending quite a bit of time on the AI side, right? And so when you kind of break that down, right, there's probably three different ways you can approach that. You know, one is you find, you know, one of the Magnificent Seven and say, hey, we'll just build something for you. You come in and take over. Probably lowest risk, but also probably lowest return, right? Because yeah. they know that.
And not something very cool like VPU.
So you have, you know, all of them running around the kind of country saying we need hundreds of megawatts because they do. So that's one way. You know, the next way is to say, hey, we're going to colo, right? We're going to build the infrastructure and then you bring your equipment and we'll run it for you.
Yeah.
That feeds well into what we do at TerraWolf, right? We're infrastructure providers, we're operators, we're design engineers, we can do construction. So that fits well into what we do. And then there's kind of, you not only build it, but then you go out and you buy all the chips as well.
Yeah.
And so again, you know, Bitcoin mining for every megawatt, right? You're probably spending, you know, $1 million, $1.2 million, you know, with GPUs with the H100s, the H200s that are coming, you're probably spending, you know, for every megawatt, $30-35 million.
Yeah.
Right. So these scale and order of magnitude of capital that's required to populate that infrastructure is pretty significant. And so, you know, so again, you can say, hey, we're playing AI, but, you know, the question I ask people when they say that is, well, how are you playing it? Right. Because each one of those paths have a different approach, different risk reward profile, and different kind of capital need. So for us, as we think about it again, what's our core? Our core is energy infrastructure. We can procure power at scale at the best possible cost. We can design and build the facilities to basically be able to house it, and we can operate it. I mean, that's our core, right? So fundamentally, that's where we start. And then we say, now, as we're thinking about that kilowatt hour of electricity, and as we're converting it, where can we kind of get the most bang for the buck? And so, you know, Bitcoin mining has been, you know, a great way to do that. But I think in addition to Bitcoin mining, as time goes on, we're going to be other ways to play it as well. And to my earlier point, understanding how these different load profiles can work together,
yeah,
I think is going to create something where 1+1 is going to equal more than 2 with respect to, again, how you can procure power at the best possible cost. And so that's where, again, in Wolf Labs, we're really trying to understand the different characteristics of these loads as well. So that, and again, 2-3 years out, we continue to maintain and hopefully even further drive down, you know, our cost of power.
So for a VPU, mm-hmm. can you just turn it off and it's like a Bitcoin miner? Doesn't matter. Like it's not.
It depends sequential on the network that you're serving. But yeah.
Would that matter for you guys?
Absolutely. And that's where, again, even with, I would say, the large scale players out there, the hyperscalers out there, you know, I always tell them, I said, if you have not thought about how your loads can be responsive, if you haven't thought about it today, you're going to have to think about it sometime tomorrow. Yeah. And so, and that's where, again, when you think about these protocols that are going to use the hardware that Michael and his team are developing, you know, my own opinion, right, from my perspective, I'm not a developer, I don't know code. So just from my perspective, you know, loads that are not responsive that just need to run 24/7 are going to have a hard time. Okay. And so for us, if we were going to deploy VPUs at scale, we'd be doing so in a way that has some level of responsiveness associated with it, right? Does it have to be as responsive as a Bitcoin miner? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
But it can't be that we just need to be there 24/7 either, because I think that kind of a load, especially at scale, starts to create complications and issues kind of back to the grid.
And in terms of the market structure, by the way, there are some interesting synergies between these different loads. So I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
There's this very hot thing. We're seeing it all over East Denver this time. And it's crypto XAI is taking off. And so, you know, Naz, you mentioned AI. It's actually a great story, because if you sell AI compute to the Magnificent Seven, there is no responsivity in that load. They are going to really care about uptime.
Yeah.
But if you're supplying AI load to, let's say, a decentralized AI network in which you're doing proof of useful work, you're mining AI coins, basically, mm-hmm. by training AI, by serving AI, that doesn't matter. You can have a responsive load. And so it's interesting, because you pair our VPU up with, let's say, one of these H100s, there's an interesting synergy. And all these companies are coming out. It's called Decentralized Physical Infrastructure Networks, DPIN for short. And basically, this is a phenomenon that really started with Filecoin and Helium, which were basically storage as a coin and, like, you know, bandwidth and network access as a coin. And now people are really moving that into AI, because what you see is that people like Naz are much better at building out infrastructure than even OpenAI. You know, I was talking to someone at OpenAI during my time at Luminous, and I think I heard that they were having trouble getting 50 megawatts. I was like, I know more than, you know, a dozen Texas Cowboys who are way better than you at, you know, finding this. So it's interesting. Like, I think that's where AI is going to go. And AI compute is such a giant market. I mean, you look at NVIDIA's earnings in the last earnings call. It's amazing. And I think there is a synergy between all of these things that's coming together at this time in history. And it's going to be wild seeing the next 18 months play out, because I think our VPUs are going to be a critical part in allowing DeepIn to happen. I think one big reason it hasn't happened yet is the cost of verifiability of those things. The cost of producing ZKs versus just doing it yourself is so big that, you know, everything centralized, as that cost comes down, as that cost premium of decentralization comes down, you're going to see a lot more, you know, tokens and tokenized forms of compute and utility tokens around things like compute, or maybe even things like energy, bandwidth, and things like that.
One thing that's kind of cool about this whole story is typically we don't see startups in the chip or hardware world be able to get off the ground very easily because it's so cost prohibitive. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing Bitcoin miners being able to, like, subsidize this because it might be a future revenue line. Mm-hmm. And so they're able to put some cash into it. Mm-hmm. So that's just one kind of aside here. In terms of the like the load profile again, what would be, and this might be like way out of bounds in terms of the question, what would be something that would fit for a Bitcoin miner's typical profile where they're able to turn off and on whenever there's a demand response moment, right? Is there something in the VPU world where that's, like, possible yet? Or is that just still too, like, theoretical?
So I would say that there are, like, kind of three kinds of services or three kinds of protocol networks that are coming out. And all of them do or eventually will have some form of tokens attached to them, right? And one form is, like, the layer two rollups, right? Everyone hears about these, right? The ZK Syncs, the Polygons, the Starkwares, right? Like, these people basically are scaling Ethereum using ZK proofs, right? This is, like, kind of one kind of protocol. Another one is the DPIN stuff that I was talking about. And another one is these proof aggregation layers that are also coming out. And, you know, all of these are heating up, right? Like, DPIN, you have companies like Jensen, which is backed by A16Z, raised $40 million. Ritual, you know, backed by Archetype, raised $25 million. Like, all these companies are really heating up. And these spaces all have one thing in common, which is, like, the immense amount of ZK compute. And so I really think that it depends on how the protocols decide to do it.
Okay.
But I think as a miner, the awesome thing about buying VPUs is that you're hedged.
Yeah.
So if one protocol chooses to make the load less responsive, chooses tokenomics that are less favorable, you know, et cetera, or maybe their token goes down in value, or maybe their network doesn't get adoption, you're de-risked because the VPU is designed to be a general purpose programmable ZK chip. So it's very different from Bitcoin mining. It can do multiple things. It's kind of like you can imagine a GPU designed for cryptography from the ground up. That's basically what we have. And so you can switch between these workloads. You can switch between these loads. If you want to be serving a responsive load, you will have a lot of options. You'll have a plethora of decentralized protocols that are okay with that.
So one thing I want to pull on here is there has been a history of different coins that Bitcoin miners have, you know, played around with. Back in the day, you go into a Bitcoin mine, there's always like a bunch of ETH miners there. And
they typically did a lot better during the bull market. So like people made sure to have those, even if they got like some shade from Bitcoin maximalists out there.
But there's always been like a host of all these different proof of work coins. And they typically just have like pretty ugly charts after a while. Mm-hmm. How do you go and convince Bitcoin miners that this is something that is worth putting their time and attention to? And I think it's a question for both you guys because you're both going to take it from a different angle.
Yeah.
So I'll start to you first.
That's a really amazing question. I would say it's two things. Number one, the fact that it's a general purpose chip kind of shields you from that kind of thing. But number two, you know, if you look at like these quote unquote altcoins as a category or like, you know, all these different protocols that are coming out, the way I look at it is there's something markedly different between these and the first wave of ICOs back in the day, like 2017, 2018. You had all these meme coins, shit coins coming out and like people were just pumping them, dumping them and spec mining, right? Like that's kind of what it felt like back then. And what you see nowadays is the value prop of the coin, whether it's scaling, whether it's processing AI, usually looks kind of like useful work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I you know, could use even the term proof of useful work. That's not necessarily the consensus mechanism that all these guys use or the tokenomics framework, but you can kind of think of it as like you're doing something useful for the world. You're not just, you know, hashing, and this hash happens to be attached to a network that has some other value propositions that are not connected at all to your hashing.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's like one huge difference is like there's real stuff going on and there's such a plethora of options. Right. I think like back when Filecoin came out, you only had Filecoin. That was like the only DPIN for a while. And that was it. Right. Nowadays, you have like, you know, 20 or 30 different projects basically coming up with networks that are centered around doing useful stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think like that's what's changed, really.
OK. And the same question to you, like how do you go to people on your board or like the other people on your team be like, this is something to put a stake in? Again, I know it's a lab right now.
And
so it's
then,
early.
And that's how we think about it, right? It's an evolution. Because again, as I said earlier, we're infrastructure, right? We provide the infrastructure for compute, and Bitcoin mining in and of itself is one. And there's all sorts of, even from the ZK side, even with respect to the Bitcoin blockchain, right? The ability to kind of add ZK proofs on top of the Bitcoin blockchain is something that's out there. So for us, it's less about we're taking a view on a protocol working or a specific kind of application working. For us, it's more about the infrastructure, right? And so when we build out a Bitcoin mine, we know we got to build out. As we've built out this kind of 2 megawatt, you know, AI application right now, we're working on kind of a 10 to 15 megawatt kind of module for running kind of HPC data centers in which we could do AI stuff. We could start working with kind of, you know, ZK hardware. And so for us, it's more about making sure that we can run and operate these things first and understand kind of the nuances to that so that both in our design, in our operation, again, how we manage these loads and how we want to integrate these loads back with our larger load. And then the market will dictate, right? So to the extent that there is use cases that are growing. And again, for us, we run hundreds of megawatts, right? So if a use case doesn't say we can't put 20, 30, 40, 50 megawatts to it, you know, it's probably not worth a ton of time to kind of go all in and try to invest into it. So for us, it's really more understanding how this all works on the front end and also having input into how it's developed, right? Because I think, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, hardware designers just kind of design and then they hope stuff works and they can kind of sell it. And so our view is that, you know, from what I've seen, right? Again, since 2018, since I've been in the space, right? We've gone through a number of cycles, is that there hasn't been this coordination between the physical infrastructure and what you want to run. And so, again, we can provide input into that. And so, again, with Michael and his team, they send us stuff and we say, hey, what about this? What about that? They said, well, can you do this? Can you do that? Right. So it's an iterative discussion that I think that creates a better profile for what is going to operate in the long run. So, again, we don't think we're taking a view in any way. What we think we're doing is we think we're preparing ourselves for, you know, the ability to serve, you know, different types of compute and making sure that we've got the tools to be able to do that. And we properly understand why we'd want to play one form of compute versus another. Right. And so that's the other thing is as we kind of look out, AI is kind of taking the world by storm here. And so everyone's saying, hey, we want to run AI. But again, even within that, there's, you know, a long list of things that kind of come up and saying, okay, well, you're going to do that. Well, how are you going to do that? What are you going to run? Who are you running it for? What's the structure? So that's where, again, to me, it's, again, less about us taking a view per se on any of this stuff on protocols and more, again, just getting the infrastructure ready and being a tool for the developers to say, hey, you know, if you're going to do this, let's, again, break it down. You're right. You can really scale this up. How does it really work? How much does it really cost? And is this something that, you know, can kind of catch hold and become a load that's, you know, fairly significant?
So this is a good time for the podcast because we've had a lot of different announcements from iRisk and to AI. We talked about that before the show started. To today, Marathon announced they have some L2 project, a merge mining project. And last week, they announced some inscription thing. To me, it seems like there's like this death knell, or I don't know what you call it, where miners are showing very clearly that they're not necessarily Bitcoin maximalists as opposed to last cycle. And it's a cultural question. I want to see if you have any input on that one.
So I mean, I think, you know, the term maxi is in and of itself loaded, right? I mean, so the three of us may have seven different opinions on what that means. And so do I consider myself a maxi? Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Bitcoin is, you know, kind of the strongest, most robust blockchain out there. And in the long run, it's going to be where most of the activity resides. Like, that's my belief. And so so I have that belief, and it shows in kind of how we're allocating the energy that we have.
Yeah.
So now, but as that goes along, as time goes along, right? I mean, the reason you're seeing kind of Bitcoin miners start to think about these is that I would say the base layer of just mining BTC and getting your block reward is going to be there every 4 years. It's going to get cut in half and the price will do what it does. And so we'll see. But there is a growing interest, right, in kind of that transaction layer, what's going to happen, right? And there's, again, 12 different views or even more on how that layer is going to be used, what it's going to be used for. And so that's where I think you're seeing people express their interest and kind of understanding which way that can go, right? And again, as fundamentally as miners, we have a meaningful role to play in how that's going to kind of play out. So for me, it's less about saying, you know, I am a maxi or not a maxi. It's more, again, that this infrastructure that we're providing, right? There's a physical infrastructure, then there's a Bitcoin infrastructure that we're providing. And again, ZK could be in addition to it, right? I mean, ZK, you know, rollups could be a layer on top of the Bitcoin layer that, and you have all of the things that Michael talked about happening on the Bitcoin layer, not on the Ethereum layer, right? So again, to me, it's not necessarily that I'm saying, you know, I'm not a Bitcoin maxi. It's, again, really kind of coming back to how do we ensure that the network that we're creating and the infrastructure that we're creating can kind of be maximized with respect to its value.
Yeah. I love asking loaded questions, by the way. So apologies. I think like the practical nature of miners is the thing that draws me towards them. It's like, let's check this out and see if it works, see if it makes money. There's something that's missing in other parts of Bitcoin that you don't really get that, where it's like, it's so much about ideology that they miss like the need to create economic value. And so that's just a critique on my point, not putting words in your mouth, but that's how I take it. I feel like, Michael, you have an unenviable position where you have to translate both worlds together. Like, you have to go talk to these Bitcoin miners who are going to be like, no, I don't want your like new thing. And then you're going to have to go talk to everyone in the other world and be like, hey, we can use this VPU for DPIN or use it for your L2. How do you cross those two cultural barriers? I mean, we're here in East Denver right now, and there's a lot of cultural stuff going on this week for crypto. So how do you like bring those together and pitch yourself to all these different startups or Bitcoin miners?
I would say maybe it's unenviable because nobody else would want to do it, but that's also where we get our edge. Is I actually love doing this stuff because You know, I think like I come from a unique background where I got into Bitcoin early. I got into mining. I got into AI. I got into, you know, the whole, you know, altcoin and then Ethereum. And then, you know, I was one of the first miners on Litecoin back in the day. So I've been through all of these different things as well as hardware. And, you know, I think like that's what I'm excited about is translating these things to each other, because at the end of the day, we're all human beings.
Yeah.
And so whatever cultural issues may exist, I think it's just a problem of communication. And if we're able to communicate with each other, and if we're able to just keep our emotions at the door and really look at what's going on, really look at what creates value for the ecosystem, I think we can all find ways to agree. And I'm really happy about that role, you know?
Are things going pretty well when you talk to Bitcoin miners so far? Are they like pretty open to the idea? Or
I would say so. You know, I would say everyone's open-minded enough to keep having conversations. And, you know, especially Nas, of course, but also other Bitcoin miners. I've seen a surprising amount of interest from Bitcoin miners who, you know, I initially thought, okay, like this is something that we're going to wait till next year and then we're going to, you know, talk about it. And then they're like, okay, tell me more. Okay, like, could I put in an order?
Yeah.
Okay, can I be the first, you know, to you know, get this thing? And so I think, like, we're seeing a surprising amount of interest, you know, and really more open-mindedness than I thought.
Yeah. Okay, so I put on the question list, last one, where's the puck going and how are you guys going to skate to it? So I'm going to let you guys answer that how you want. But the first thing that I'm curious about is, like, for these L2s, is roll-ups are a big topic right now. There's many airdrops that have occurred and will occur. And I think it's going to be like L2 season, like ICO season. Like that's just going to...
This year.
Yeah, it's going to be how it is. Some of these roll-ups use ZKs as a security backbone, if you will. What does this look like for you guys? And even if like there isn't a VPU out there, how are they going to develop? Like where does all this fit together? From your perspective. And then we'll get to the last question about like, you know, future out stuff.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So I think like as for the rollups, we play a really critical role. We let them scale their TPS, which is the whole point of rollups. And, you know, I think like a lot of people are saying, hey, well, that block space, like who's going to use it? I can tell you like lots of people are clamoring to use block space, especially when the proving is in some way incentivized. And so, you know, I was just talking to some traders who were like, oh, yeah, like, you know, these companies like, you know, Jane Street, they want to do 1 million TPS if they could.
Yeah.
Right. They just can't economically do it right now. So as that marginal value of a transaction drops, you're going to see a lot of activity. I think like I was on a panel with Cooper, the head of decentralization from Aztec the other day, and he was saying, yeah, like this is a sponge. It's going to soak up whatever compute you throw at it. I really believe that. I think that's where it's going this year. But further out, there's even other stuff that's also very interesting.
Have you seen any pushback from ETH culture about building special purpose hardware for these sort of things?
I would say that if you explain the value that the hardware is able to bring the ecosystem and you don't try to be a monopolist Bitmain, I think like that's what people are really burdened by, is that Bitmain dominated the world of crypto hardware for so long. And people are really tired of how Bitmain behaves. People are really tired of like the way they treat their customers, the way they treat the ecosystem. People are, you know, looking at even the block size wars like almost 10 years ago, they still have the memory of that.
Yeah.
And even though that happened in Bitcoin, you know, everyone knows that like any, you know, kind of thing that could be a possibility, right? So what we try to do is we try to be super friendly and win-win, and we really try to benefit the community and not just ourselves. And I think that ends up showing up in how people react to us. You know, we're not a typical hardware manufacturer because we're not mercenary. We're about the mission. We're about getting ZKs out there, democratizing ZK. And that's the whole message of this company.
Yeah. So where is the puck going, do you think? Where are we going to look at in 12, 18 months?
I think
he's got an easy answer. He's going to say hash rate's up, Bitcoin's up. But like harder one here.
Here are some interesting predictions, and we can revisit, I guess, next ETH Denver to see how I'm doing. But one of my predictions is, you know, Bitcoin transaction fees, the way Satoshi envisioned them is after halving this time, people on Bitcoin Talk back in 2014 were saying, yeah, once it gets to 3.125, transaction fees will hopefully start coming up. And what we see is that yes, they are starting to come up, but simultaneously, because we have all this amazing ZK technology now, mm-hmm. people are talking about Bitcoin ZK L2s, and there are like 20 of them that are VC funded now. That's like a way to actually reduce those fees. And so what if that ends up shifting away from the native block reward?
Yeah.
Could happen, right? So that's like one thing I'm paying attention to. Another very exciting thing, this is like possibly the biggest TAM ever, is like, you know, I think that a lot of compute is going to shift into decentralized networks, DPIN. And all of that DPIN is going to require an enormous amount of verification compute. And so when you see these networks like Jensen, like Ritual in their infancy right now, you know, what you don't think of is that there is $600 billion a year in computer hardware sold. NVIDIA is doing something like $30 billion, what was it, a quarter a year? Something like crazy, absolutely crazy. And this kind of volume, if that were to move into a tokenized format, that token would be one of the top three crypto tokens. It would be Bitcoin, Ethereum, and then this token, or maybe like some other ordering, right?
Yeah.
I don't know which one is going to win, but I do know that the incentive structure that tokenomics inherently has starts that flywheel. And when you have the demand side, like we're seeing with AI hardware, and when you have the, you know, whole narrative around, hey, like AI should be decentralized, like, you know, people like Andre Karpathy, the former director of AI at Tesla, who's, you know, at OpenAI, people like that are talking about, hey, like AI should be decentralized. Control should be taken out of the hands of the few, right? And when you see like all this concern about privacy, all this concern about IP, you know, OpenAI got sued by the New York Times for like taking all their data. When you see stuff like this, you're like, okay, this is going to go to DPIN,
yeah.
right? And that is so humongous. It's going to be a multi-trillion dollar opportunity for all the companies that participate in it. So that's like one really exciting thing.
Love it. Okay, same question to you.
So, I mean, the Bitcoin is probably the poster child, right, for a decentralized compute network, right? I mean, it's a $1 trillion decentralized computational network that exists. And so when you say kind of where's the puck going, I think Bitcoin has shown that decentralization and compute is extremely valuable. And so we continue to see the puck kind of going in that direction. And so a lot of things that we are looking at and trying to understand is, you know, what are other things that are going to come off of that? And so, you know, so obviously we're going to continue to put up Bitcoin mining buildings. You know, we kind of put them up in 50 megawatt chunks, you know, 3 exahash today, could be more exahash, you know, as time goes on.
I'm using that offhand, like it's like 50 megawatts is like a person's life.
Yeah.
And he's like,
so that's going to continue. And then that's where I just see again the value. And again, especially with, you know, all of this talk around AI. And to Michael's point, I really do believe that without some sort of decentralization around it, it's not going to be what people think.
Mm-hmm.
And that again comes back to the infrastructure. You know, how is the infrastructure there to kind of be able to support that? So that's where we're really spending time and thinking about and trying to understand. And you know, I always tell people there's you know certain things that I know, and there's a bunch of stuff that I don't know, right? And so our job is really to, you know, build off of what we know and try to position ourselves for the 101 things that we don't know, right? And that's where again this intersection of kind of, you know, energy and compute is where, you know, we see that, you know, kind of continuing to go. And that's where, you know, we'll
This is not a question because it'd be completely unfair, but I'm curious to see like where Bitcoin's hash rate would be if there wasn't subsidies for other networks versus what's going to occur, right? So like you guys putting investments into VPU projects and let's say that those take off and see kind of where Bitcoin miners, their hash rate, or their energy.
I don't think it's going to impact it. I mean, I think, you know, Bitcoin's its own enigma.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be 800 by the end of the year.
I mean,
I think the network hash rate will be 800 by the end of 24. Okay. I mean, so I think that's going to continue to grow. And again, when you think about what it takes to get to 800, right? That's decisions being made today, yesterday, last month, 2 months ago, right? So the other thing is that all of this is evolving and developing. And so no one today is sitting here saying, I'm not going to put up, you know, 3x a hash because I'm going to go do something else, right? They're going to try to put up 3x a hash. And when that comes out in June or August or September, those decisions are being made now.
Yeah.
And if you look at all of the orders the larger miners have done, right, they've kind of bought miners out through 2025.
Yeah.
So to me, I don't think in the near term, let's call it 12, 18 months, that it's really going to have an impact. And again, I just think when you kind of roll it back, you know, we're going to go through a halving. People have different views on transaction fees, right? So the economics of Bitcoin mining, you know,
yeah,
if price keeps going, maybe they kind of people think about the same way. If price doesn't, you know, maybe people think about the other way. And again, the infrastructure that all of these miners have to kind of deliver compute will continue. I mean, I think all of us really always think about, you know, what's the highest and best use for that. So, yeah. So I think in the near term, I don't think to the extent that this catches on, it's going to really change it. And just look at the example of AI, right? I mean, AI has kind of come and the demand for AI has gone from not much to gigawatts
yeah.
in a very short period of time. But if you really break down how many megawatts of AI that Bitcoin miners are running, I'd still say it's probably less than 20.
Yeah. Press releases make it seem like it's different.
Press releases make it seem like it's a lot more, but if you really, really add it all up, you know, I would think that, you know, for equipment that Bitcoin miners own,
yeah.
and maybe on hosting, you know, maybe you can kind of get to a little bit of a bigger number, but the equipment that Bitcoin miners own for AI, I would, you know, say is less than 20 megawatts.
Guys, thanks for joining the Mining Pod. That was great.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.